call to order the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is January 16th, and we are convened for the purposes of an informational meeting on Legislative Concept 205, Legislative Concept 209, and Legislative Concept
265.
And this is only an informational meeting with invited testimony, but I would like to change course a little bit. And if somebody has an opinion on these LCs, might as well flesh them out now. So please feel free to approach the committee assistant or just come up to the table if you'd like to testify on any of these LCs. And then we will do a work session once we get a quorum. So I guess actually we've opened a subcommittee.
Correct.
Of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection at this time. So, that being said, Chana, why don't you tell us what we need to do?
All right. Certainly, Chair Shields, Senator Mona Sanderson. First up, we're going to hear about LC 205, which is a committee bill. It is about automatic license plate reader systems. And these are small cameras attached to police cars or some sort of structure, and they automatically capture and store with the timestamp license plate data. LC 205 was co-sponsored by Senator George, and it restricts the use of these cameras and the retention of the data collected.
Okay. Thank you, Chana. Representative Williamson, if you could please come forward, and David Fedenke. David, welcome. Do I need to open? Yeah. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
Our quorum just arrived.
Chair Shields, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Przanski, thanks for having me here today. I'm Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, the west side of Portland. And I'm here to testify today on Legislative Concept 205 because I believe that we're at a pivotal time in our nation's history, really, around technology and the challenges that technology is bringing to some of our core constitutional principles and the tests that we're facing with some of our basic constitutional principles. We know that on a national level and even an international level, people are beginning to see the extent of government surveillance capability with new technology, and that capability being directed at citizens, not just suspected terrorists, but mass data collection on citizens. And the complications that collecting and storing that data has. So the question I'm here to ask the committee is, what kind of threat to our individual liberty does that bring, and how are we thinking about mass collection of data and storage of data? And is that collection and storage doing anything to keep us safer, and is it worth it? What's the balance there, and what's the constitutional question? So I think it's important that we recognize that the state has a role in managing that. That conversation is happening robustly at the federal level, but I would like to see it happening more often at the state level as well, because I believe as policymakers we have a role, and that the federal government will be looking like they often do at the states for leadership in new and developing areas of the law. And I believe that tension between privacy and technology is continuing at a faster and faster pace developing. And I think it's our job to protect Oregonians' right to privacy. So the use of automatic license plate reader surveillance technology in the state right now demonstrates that the same surveillance issues and data collection that we know are occurring nationally are also occurring locally. And there are very legitimate uses for surveillance and data collection. And it can and does keep us safe, but we need to have smart policies to manage that collection and storage. It's a core principle in this country that the government does not invade people's privacy indiscriminately or collect data on citizens' innocent activities just in case they do something wrong. We are innocent until proven guilty in this country, and it's not the other way around. So I think it's time that we get ahead of this new technology. We create smart policies before this technology is more commonplace in the state than it is. And we figure out a regime in which we understand that the dissemination of this information without limitations is not good policy. We know that law enforcement capabilities for systems that pool stored license plate information across jurisdictions is not far off in the state, and in some places in the country, they're already using that. And if current trends continue, we will eventually see the construction of a national database, I believe, or interlinked databases allowing for intergovernment agency and possibly nationwide data mining of this information. So I think LC 205 is a modest bill, and it takes a pretty reasonable approach to managing this data collection and storage. It doesn't propose a ban on any surveillance technology, but it provides, I believe, clear, concise, consistent policy across the state to help law enforcement solve crimes and protect the privacy of our records and, you know, the records of our daily movement of Oregonians across the state.
Thank you, Representative. David, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and I'll be presenting testimony prepared by our Legislative Director, Becky Strauss, who couldn't be here because of the flu. Thanks for the opportunity to testify this afternoon in support of LC 205 and for your interest in this proposal, which would set out guidelines for the use of automatic license plate reader surveillance technology by public agencies in Oregon, including law enforcement. We appreciate this opportunity to lay out the issues and the specifics of the bill concept in anticipation of the start of session just a few weeks away. Automatic license plate readers are cameras mounted on stationary objects, such as telephone poles, the underside of bridges, or on patrol cars and other governmental vehicles. Cameras snap a photograph of every license plate that passes them by or that they pass, capturing that information on up to thousands of cars per minute. The devices convert each license plate number into machine-readable text and check them against agency-selected databases or manually entered license plate numbers, providing an alert to a patrol officer or other person whenever a match or a hit appears in the system. When an automatic license plate reader system captures an image of a car, it also meta-tags each file with the GPS location and the time and date showing where and when the photograph was snapped. The system gathers this information on each car it comes into contact with, not simply those to which some flag or hit is attached. As ALPRs become increasingly widespread, they are being put to a variety of uses. One of the most common law enforcement uses of license plate readers is to check plates against hot lists such as missing persons or outstanding warrant databases. Data collected from ALPRs can also be pooled in centralized databases. Software can be used to plot all of the plate reads associated with a particular vehicle to trace any person's past movements whose vehicle shows up in the system. The system can also plot all vehicles at a particular location, such as the location where a crime or, say, a political protest took place. Additional uses for license plate readers are arising as the cameras become more affordable and widespread. Vehicle verification. Photographs captured by ALPRs may contain more than simply the license plate and sometimes include a substantial part of a vehicle, its occupants, and its immediate vicinity. Law enforcement can use captured photographs to verify witness descriptions of vehicles and confirm identifying features. Photographs of cars and drivers can also be printed and distributed to the press and the news media. Geofencing. Law enforcement or private companies can construct a virtual fence around a designated geographical area to identify each vehicle entering or leaving that space. For example, in Tiburon, California, ALPRs monitor its only two roads, which provide the capability to track every person who enters or leaves the city of Tiburon. Non-law enforcement purposes. ALPRs can also be used for other purposes such as repossession of vehicles and parking enforcement. When used in a narrow and carefully regulated way, automatic license plate readers can help police recover stolen cars and arrest people without standing warrants without violating individual privacy rights. Unfortunately, automatic license plate readers are, for the most part, not being used in a narrow and carefully regulated way. The systems routinely store information on the location of innocent people. The scanning and storage capabilities of these cameras and data systems have grown exponentially since their introduction, as the cost of digital storage has been coming down dramatically. Because of these falling costs and the availability of federal grants to cover the upfront capital costs for these purchases, automatic license plate readers' ubiquity has also grown exponentially. Over time, these devices are creating a massive trove of personal data, searchable logs capable of tracking the movements of tens of thousands of innocent Oregonians going about their private business. This technology can be used to track the movements of people who attend a protest or a political event, attend a particular church or other place of worship, or visit even a particular physician. Keeping track of suspected wrongdoers is one thing, but clear regulations must be put in place to keep authorities from tracking those who have done nothing wrong. State laws should prohibit automatic license plate readers from storing or recording data after a reasonable period of time where there is no match to an offender list or other individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. The increased proliferation and advanced capability of surveillance technology raises issues that aren't unique to ALPRs. Policymakers and members of the public should be asking a standard set of questions about all uses of surveillance technology, and these questions can then be a roadmap to creating reasonable guidelines relating to license plate readers and other similar kinds of surveillance technology. In what instances and with what limitations may the technology be used? What type of information is being collected and about whom? What happens to the data after it's collected? Can it be shared? How long is it kept? Do individuals have the opportunity to know what information has been collected about them and correct any inaccuracies? Are there auditing mechanisms in place to ensure compliance with privacy safeguards and ensure the effectiveness of the technology for its original purpose? Has the public been notified of the usage of the technology and any policy changes? Currently, there is a great lack of consistency regarding ALPR policies where they are being used in Oregon. In July of 2012, the ACLU of Oregon queried a number of law enforcement agencies throughout the state, and it was a select group, I should make clear. We did not query every law enforcement agency, to find out where ALPRs were being utilized and to determine what policies, if any, are governing their use. What we found of the handful of agencies that responded at that time is that there is a clear lack of consistency regarding answers to the privacy roadmap questions we identified above. This inconsistency signals an urgent need to be thoughtful about how license plate reader surveillance is being applied in Oregon and how we can use it in a way that will protect privacy. We've laid out a table in our testimony that shows the uses as of July 2012, and we recognize that things may have changed since then. In the City of Medford Police Department, the Oregon City Police Department, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, Salem Police Department, and the Portland Police Bureau. And just to point out a few facts, in Medford and Oregon City, the retention policies provided that the records should be purged unless it has become or is reasonable to believe it will become evidence. In Clackamas County, the records, the data is being kept for 10 years. In Oregon City and Salem, there were no retention policies. And in Portland, the data is kept for a minimum of 30 days, but most of the data, as we understand it, is being kept for 4 years. Without any suspicion that an individual has committed a crime, ALPRs are used to search agency databases for that person's information. At the very least, clear policies and regulations must be put in place to prohibit storing or recording data where there is no match to an offender list or evidence of wrongdoing. LC-205 proposes guidelines to enable the use of ALPRs for public safety purposes, but also protect the privacy of innocent Oregonians. The bill does not do anything to hinder the use of ALPRs that are laid out in current law enforcement policies, and it provides additional benefit by putting forth sensible privacy restrictions in a way that will be implemented consistently across the state. Section 2 of the bill provides for usage that would be permitted. It would permit the Oregon Department of Transportation to use ALPR technology for regulating motor carriers and also for collecting tolls. And let me just insert that ODOT has suggested some conceptual amendments that we have no problem with in concept and are committed to working that out in an expeditious way. Law enforcement under Section 2 of the bill could use ALPR surveillance technology for enforcing parking restrictions, for traffic violations, and for investigating crime. Section 2 also lists the databases that ALPR could be matched against. The Oregon Department of Transportation, National Crime Information Center, U.S. Department of Justice, state law enforcement data system, as well as state and federal missing persons lists. Section 3 would regulate how the data could be shared. It would allow public bodies to share data with other public bodies as long as all of those public bodies comply with the retention requirements set out in this legislation. Public bodies could obtain data collected by private entities with a court order. Records would be exempt from public disclosure except that a registered owner or someone with their permission could access the records of that particular owner's vehicle. Section 3 sets out retention standards. All data collected by law enforcement agencies could be kept for up to 14 days. After 14 days, the process for retention would break into two categories. HIT data, that is data that returned a HIT from one of those databases that indicated there was a reason to be going after that vehicle or the person in that vehicle, could be kept if it was needed for an ongoing criminal investigation. And non-HIT data could be kept pursuant to a court order based on reasonable suspicion that the data is or would be needed for an ongoing criminal investigation. Section 4 deals with transparency protections. It would require agencies using ALPR surveillance technology to adopt and post on their website their policies governing their use of ALPR technology and to make public reports annually on how they are using the technology. Of course, the ACLU of Oregon urges your support of this legislation. The use of advanced surveillance technology is increasing at a rate much faster than governmental policies and statutes have been able to keep up with. Moreover, public notice regarding the use of these technologies for surveillance is extremely limited. is now the time for the legislature to adopt these modest privacy safeguards and transparency mechanisms to provide uniform practices in Oregon before the use of this technology becomes more widespread. We urge your support of LC-205. Thank you again for this opportunity, Chair Shields and member of the committee.
Testimony. Thank you. Senator Morris Anderson.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for bringing this legislation forward. I am just concerned about the 14-day limitation. When there's terrorist activity or espionage and there isn't an active criminal investigation, but this information could maybe be useful even in serial killings or, you know, those things that are happening, but we don't know who or what, but maybe this data that was in the system could help that. Of course, I'd like to hear from the law enforcement, but it seems like the 14-day window is pretty short.
If that were the hard and fast rules, Senator Monis Anderson, I would absolutely agree with you. And we agree that this data could be useful in criminal investigations, which is why we allowed for a law enforcement agency to go to a local judge to get approval to retain the data. For example, if any major crime has occurred, the law enforcement agency could go to a judge and ask for approval to keep that data because it could be useful as they develop more facts related to that investigation. And Section 3, Sub 2A on lines 19 through 22 provides that authority for the agency to go to a court and get that approval to keep the data. And that permission can be renewed as long as it is needed or the agency thinks it will be needed for an ongoing investigation.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. But if it's purged after 14 days...
In that case, the data would not be purged. The data could be maintained.
But you wouldn't know... I mean, if there is a criminal activity, but you didn't know within that 14-day window, but things came up maybe a month later or 60 days later, that it would be off the record, so that could not. That's what this would do, correct?
Okay. Senator Anderson and Chair Shields, members of the committee, if it is unknown that a crime has occurred, a major crime, number one, that is quite unusual that law enforcement would not be aware of a major crime within 14 days. We are more than willing to discuss with law enforcement what they think would be a period of time that they would absolutely need to have this data. Unfortunately, they have not been willing to have that discussion, at least the Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association have not been open to that conversation. They have merely asked that this issue be set over until 2015. Our experience has been that, and from talking to other law enforcement folks, is that it's highly unusual that a major crime would go undiscovered for that length of time. But if, you know, there is 30 days or something else that law enforcement folks can give us data to back up, we're more than willing to talk to them about that. And let me just add one point to this, which is that we should be having these discussions before surveillance technology is put in place, and particularly before surveillance technology is put in place that has the ability to track the movements of thousands of innocent persons. you know, if it occurs that in the wisdom of this committee that you feel that we cannot do justice to this issue in this February session, we would strongly encourage you to put a moratorium on the use of this technology until reasonable restrictions can be put in place.
Okay. Senator Przanski?
No, fine.
Great. Well, we'll have plenty of time to discuss this come February as well, so we really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Like I said, we're going to shift a little bit, so if anybody has an opinion about this, particularly any of the opponents that want to come share your point of view, now would be the time to do it. Should breeze right through then. I don't have to gavel, right? So we will next move on to the review of the legislative concept 209 relating to health care coverage. Could we please bring up Paul Turtle and Loretta Buskovic? Loretta. Okay.
Hello?
Ms. Buskovic?
Yes?
Hi, this is Senator Chip Shields, and you are live with the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection.
Oh, great. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
And Paul Turtle is at the dais, what's the word I'm looking for?
Witness table.
Witness table, yes, thank you. Paul, how would you like to proceed?
How about if I go first with a background, and then Loretta, and then we can do questions?
Great.
So, Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Paul Turdall. I live in Northwest Portland in Senate District 18, and I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about LC 209. I speak as a boy of a father of two boys with autism who received mental health treatment for that, as well as the Oregon State Policy Chair for Autism Speaks, and as a leader of an ad hoc organization of about 700 individuals interested in insurance coverage issues related to autism. LC 209 is basically intended to address a loophole in the coverage for public employees in PEB, OEB, and OHSU that I think most people probably didn't fully appreciate existed. The public employees plan, like all self-insured plans, Nike or any major company, are not insurance. They are legally not considered insurance, which means they are completely exempt from the state insurance code. So whenever we pass insurance mandates of any kind, they have no actual impact on public employees in the self-insured plans by PEB, OEB, or for OHSU. Cities and counties are actually different. So when cities and counties have self-insured plans for their employees, there is a different clause in the insurance code which loops them in and says, yes, you're technically exempt provided that you comply with certain elements of the insurance code. There is no such clause for PEB and OEB and OHSU, so that all of the insurance mandates, none of the insurance mandates apply to those plans. So, last year when we were working on Senate Bill 365, we had lots of language around how the plans are going to affect PEB and OEB in particular. And, the fiscal impact statement was actually based, for PEB at least, entirely on the impact of the self-insured PEB plan, because the Kaiser plan, which is fully insured, was already complying with what we were asking for in Senate Bill 365 anyway. Now, PEB, we understand that PEB and OEB have every intention of complying with what was spelled out in Senate Bill 365, that they're working on it. We really appreciate that. The law doesn't actually apply to them, as it is structured. This is based on the advice of the insurance commissioner. I have, in the pack that I distributed, the second page is an email from the insurance commissioner just sort of describing her analysis of this. What we're asking about is not just, you know, re-clarifying that Senate Bill 365 does actually apply as intended to PEB and OEB. We're doing a couple of things. One is we are also asking it to apply to the Oregon Health Sciences University, which is a different related system, to make sure that it covers those employees. And secondly, we are asking that all three of those plans be required to comply with Oregon's mental health parity law and an older autism bill, which were all designed to work together with Senate Bill 365. There are, we have had a number of issues with PEB members and with OHSU members trying to get access to mental health coverage through their plans. More recently, PEB's plan, by contract, has a clause voluntarily opting into Oregon's mental health parity statute. That came in last year. We appreciate that. Prior years, there was no such clause, and in September of 2012, I went with a PEB member to a grievance committee hearing by PEB's plan administrator seeking mental health coverage for a child with autism. And, I asked very directly, can you confirm yes or no whether or not you're covered by Oregon's mental health parity statute? And the answer is no, we are not. And in their denial, they would not accept any arguments regarding what Oregon's mental health parity law required. There are clauses in both the PEB contract and in the OHSU contract that, based on legal review, we believe are inconsistent with the mental health parity law, the other statutes, and the requirements we impose on commercial insurers. Let me point out a couple of examples. So I have a couple of example pages from some PEB and OHSU handbooks. So this is about midway through your packet. This is an exclusion that PEB has in its mental health section for public employees. I highlighted it. So they exclude all services related to developmental disabilities, developmental delays, or learning disabilities. That could be interpreted in a way that is consistent with the law. Our mental health parity law does not cover treatment for, all developmental disabilities. It does require treatment for autism. It does not require treatment for intellectual disabilities. PEB has taken an extremely broad and aggressive interpretation of this clause. They have issued denial letters that state, and I'm quoting directly here, because applied behavior analysis is related to autism, it is not covered. So again, Oregon's mental health parity law requires coverage of autism in parity. PEB has issued denial letters asserting that because the mental health service requested is a treatment for autism, it's excluded. They have actually gone further than that, and last month, I got a call for help from the head of the neurobehavioral unit at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore. There was a PEB member, 12-year-old boy, who had very severe psychiatric distress, extreme self-injurious behavior, as in constantly, hitting himself and causing harm involuntarily. He was not suicidal. He didn't want to harm himself. But because of a psychiatric distress, he could not stop. He was under DHS care in a group home. He was under constant round-the-clock assistance to help him prevent himself from harming himself. His psychologist at OHSU wanted him given resident or inpatient treatment at Johns Hopkins, which is a very good facility that has a specialty in treating that kind of condition. PEB's initial denial letter stated that they were denying coverage because he was intellectually disabled. That was PEB's initial response. Because the referral indicated that it was intellectually disabled, they were denying it based on that clause. you know, we spent about a week working on it. I organized physicians at Johns Hopkins, physicians at OHSU, you know, several attorneys who volunteered their time. You know, when PEB came back after discussions, they realized that Johns Hopkins, in addition to using medication and psychotherapy, also used applied behavior analysis in their treatment. They came back with a new, and also learned the patient had autism as well as intellectual disability. They came back with a new denial and asserted, well, because Johns Hopkins is going to use ABA techniques alongside medication and everything else, we're excluding that because ABA is related to developmental disabilities. That could very easily have ended up in court. What I think the plan administrator understood, they didn't really want to go there. And what we worked out is that they allowed this case to go to an external review organization, you know, an independent review organization appointed by the insurance division on an emergency basis. And that IRO basically said, well, of course ABA is a proven technique. Of course this kid needs it, and overturned it. IRO had no authority to overturn the contractual, you know, clause. Upon receiving that IRO, PEB, you know, basically dropped their objections and approved, and I'm very happy to say the boy is there, he's getting the treatment that he needs, and it's working out for him. But we shouldn't have to have that kind of problem. You know, we should not be getting denial letters from PEB saying we're not going to pay for kids, you know, who have intellectual disabilities, we're not going to pay for kids who are seeking a treatment that is in some tangential way related to developmental disabilities, even if that's not what is being, you know, being treated. We have other issues with, you know, this is also what is also applying to the Oregon Health Sciences University. For several years now, we have been working with OHSU to provide coverage for its own employees who have children with autism. That has repeatedly been escalated to the level of President Robertson. We've had numerous discussions. Currently, PEB has a clause in the contract. This is the last page. This is an exclusion that says they will not pay for applied behavior analysis, even if it is medically necessary, even if it relates to a condition covered by the plan, even if it is recommended, referred, or provided by an in-network provider. They just won't cover it. This is nothing to do with the evidence. This is nothing to do with medical necessity. They're saying we will not pay for this mental health treatment, period, end of story. If this plan were complying with Oregon's mental health parity statute, you couldn't do that. Oregon's mental health parity statute requires coverage of treatment for mental health conditions. It would be legitimate to refuse a treatment that was not medically necessary. It would be legitimate to refuse a treatment that, you know, was experimental or was in some way not a valid medical service. They're saying they won't cover it even if it is one of those things. That would just not be permitted by Oregon statute. I should add, you know, per advice of the insurance commissioner, both of these plans are required to comply with the federal mental health parity statute, which is, you know, structured differently, has different requirements, and we do believe that both PEB and OHSU's employee plans are not complying with that federal statute, and there is some risk to them regarding that, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about making sure that, you know, the Oregon statutes apply, you know, to public employees the same way they apply to commercial insured plans. So, thank you.
Okay. Questions? Ms. Boskovic.
Okay. My name is Loretta Boskovic, and I live in Senate District 22, represented by Senator Shields, and House District 44, represented by Representative Kotek. I'm the mother of a 12-year-old boy with autism who has received applied behavior analysis treatment, ABA, since age 3.5. I work for Family and Community Together, Oregon's Parent Training and Information Center, on issues related to special education, and I am the co-chair of the Autism Program's Family Advisory Committee up at OHSU. I appreciate this opportunity to testify to you today about why Legislative Concept 209 is so important in closing the loophole that self-insured plans like OHSU and PEB are using to avoid coverage of ABA. I remember how excited and relieved many, many families were around the state when they found out that the health insurers were finally going to start covering ABA next year and the year after. Unfortunately, this news left out a lot of people, including employees of OHSU and those who are eligible for PEP and OLIP. In March of 2013, the Family Advisory Committee to the Autism Program up at OHSU contacted Dr. Brian Rogers, and he's the director of the Institute on Development and Disability at OHSU, and we were seeking clarification from him on his opinion regarding the use of ADA with children experiencing autism. And he wrote us back, and I'll quote what he wrote. He said, "I believe that there is an extensive body of research that supports the use of ADA-based treatments to reduce problem behaviors and increase functional skills for children and youth with autism and related disorders and intellectual disabilities. Many effective treatments utilize the principles of intensive ADA along with other behaviorally based treatment modalities to meet the individual needs of children with developmental disabilities. I strongly support healthcare coverage of intensive ABA and other behaviorally based treatment programs for children with autism and related disorders and intellectual disabilities that are based on the results of comprehensive evaluations by well-trained developmental and health professionals." And in addition, in the time that I've been the co-chair of the Family Advisory Committee, coming up on 2 years now, it's been repeatedly reported to our members that ADA is routinely prescribed by OHSU clinicians for children who are diagnosed by its autism clinic. So shifting gears a little bit in regards to PEB, my husband was hired by DHS in December, and so we transitioned from an employer-based insurance coverage through Providence Health Plan to PEP's Providence Choice. One important fact that I have to note is that Providence has covered our son's intensive ABA therapy since 2007 when an independent review organization overturned Providence's denial of coverage. So knowing that the job move was imminent, I contacted Providence in the middle of December and let them know that we were still going to be with Providence, just with a new plan. In the meantime, I purchased a gold standard Providence plan through Cover Oregon that was identical in coverage to the employer-based plan and called Providence, who confirmed to me that PEB was going to be our primary plan. 2 days before the end of the year, Providence contacted me to let me know that its Providence PEB plan would not honor the IRO decision any longer because it was a self-funded plan. And, you know, I came to find out that this flies in the face of SB 365, which has a clause that requires insurers who are providing coverage of ABA therapy in accordance with the decision of an IRO made prior to January 1st, 2016, to continue providing that coverage, subject to a treatment plan as outlined in SB 365. So in getting some clarification from Providence, they wrote me a letter from last week that states, "The situation raised by your request presents unique issues, unlike most cases, because of the claims history with your prior coverage with Providence Health Plan, unrelated to PEB, because of Providence Health Plan's fiduciary obligations to PEB under your new plan, and because of the obligation that PEB will have in 2015 under SB 365 to provide ADA services to members for whom these services are medically necessary. Currently, Providence plans to cover 60 days of ABA while it reviews the medical necessity of this treatment for my son. I fear that we're going to be facing months of game playing and bait and switch tactics that Providence is known for in its efforts to deny ADA to children and that our family has experienced in the past. So, you know, I have to ask, why would anybody deal with this? And my husband and I strongly believe that our son continues to make progress towards independence and self-sufficiency, and that he deserves to receive the treatment just like a child with cancer or diabetes or muscular dystrophy deserves ongoing treatment that moves him or her towards a better, healthier life. PEB, OEB, and OHSU should not be allowed to continue denying ADA coverage for children. OLC 209 will give families hope for the future, and it will help professionalize service delivery and provide that stability to OHSU employees and PEB and OEB recipients, which they're currently missing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Loretta. Any questions for her? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Boscovic, for bringing this, for testifying on this important issue. But my question is to Paul primarily. Under the Cover Oregon, this wouldn't be a problem, or is it?
So the particular problem we're solving is regarding applicability of the statutes, and the statutes apply to cover Oregon. What, you know, it remains, you know, what is a little bit challenging is interpretation and enforcement of those statutes. So, you know, in, Loretta's case, you know, she bought two plans because she wanted to make sure that, you know, she had a backup and that she was covered. You know, there is, you know, I believe, my attorneys believe that, you know, the clauses that you know, I have pointed out are inconsistent with state law. The interpretation is inconsistent with state law. There is currently a class action lawsuit regarding those issues that does not apply to PEB. It applies only to employer-based, you know, plans that comply with state, you know, regulation. We should have an answer from the courts by that in, say, May or June. And I think that will provide a lot of clarity towards, you know, what the state law requires. You know, we are having issues, and we are having a lot of inconsistent treatment from insurers. So Kaiser, for instance, is doing a great job. They are covering, you know, they've been covering this treatment for over a year, not because, you know, any new laws were passed, not because they changed their contract or their plan. They came to the realization that their contract already covered this, and was the right thing to do for their patients. We're getting different treatment from insurers. So Regents, for instance, Regents' sole basis for denial at this point is that ABA is experimental and unproven, which is kind of a softball denial because all we do is we send it to an external review, independent review organization. We get it overturned. They provide coverage, and we all move on, and we don't have to go to court. It's a nuisance, but, you know, we're getting the coverage, and we've taken several families through the process already. We have to an IRO right now. You know, Pacific Source, they have been covering this for several years under court order. We have a few issues about what providers are they're qualifying, but the patients are getting their coverage. Moda, which is also covering OHSU, what they're asserting is that this is not a medical service. They're asserting it's an educational service. We haven't finished our way through the process on that. We may end up taking that to external review to clarify that question. If not, then that would go back to court. So, you know, the specific legal problem we're solving, you're right, that Cover Oregon, you know, is not exposed to that problem because the statutes clearly apply.
Okay. All right. It seems like we solved this problem, but evidently we didn't because I didn't know the ramifications of self-insured and the contracts that are set up between payers and
You know, 2 years ago we went through this whole bit with the fiscal impact of Senate Bill 555, and it turns out, as written, there wasn't a fiscal impact because it was all based on the cost of PEB, which was completely exempt. So
that's probably why we did it, so that we would get it passed.
Right. Yeah. We didn't intend to exempt it. I mean, this was 2 years ago. We intended to include PEB and OEB. The fiscal was built on PEB and OEB.
It was.
But it didn't actually require it. We didn't know. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when we wrote the fiscal impact statement on Senate Bill 365 last year, we clearly required PEB. We required different things. The fiscal impact statement was based explicitly on the impact on PEB self-insured plans. We now understand from the insurance commissioner, and I believe the insurance commissioner is correct, that it doesn't actually really apply to PEB and OEB.
And so basically we, you know, through all these painful negotiations last session, it was just a mistake in the drafting.
Yeah, and we had considered the issue. My first draft, when I sent it in a year and a half ago, I explicitly asked the question, do we need to put in a clause in the statute empowering PEB to address this issue? The feedback at the time was no. That was before we talked to the insurance commissioner about some of these other issues. And we just had so much going on in the negotiations that you know, that was an open question in my mind at the time. So,
okay.
Step at a time.
Good. Well, that's why we have annual sessions.
Yes.
Continuing sessions to improve upon legislation. All right. Paul, thank you very much for your testimony. Loretta, thank you for your testimony. I see Commissioner Cowley is here. do you want to come? I don't think I have any questions, but
I'm happy to answer questions, but I'm happy to take your comments.
Okay, and then we'll have the February session to discuss this as well.
Payers, are they going to?
Let's open it up. So if anybody else would like to testify on this, please feel free to come forward. Once again, bill without any controversy in my committee. All right, so we will go ahead and move on to the next legislative concept, Legislative Concept 265. Could we please bring up Kelly Bach and Teresa Jahanger and Chief Coons?
So 265 was not on the agenda, or I just missed it?
We didn't have the actual number. It's the third agenda item on the agenda.
Correct, Jana?
Correct.
It says review of legislative concept relating to consumer protection. The actual relating to clause, though, for those who care about relating to clauses in our committee, is?
Relating to restoration work.
Yes, a little bit tighter than the original. Great. Welcome to the committee. Would you like to go first, Teresa?
Sure.
Tell us your story.
Sure.
Please. Please do. And just introduce yourself to the committee and tell us what happened. And we were really pleased that you came forward and brought this to us.
Sure. So my name is Teresa Jahanger. I currently live in District 22 under Senator Rosenbaum and Bailey. However, the incident that I'm going to speak about happened when I lived in your district, Senator Shields. So I just decided to read the email that I sent to you,
sure.
And then I can extrapolate if necessary. So I was a victim of a five-alarm fire in Northeast Portland on August 8th, where my house burned slash melted slash had 130 million gallons of water poured on it. So all my stuff was ruined. So on the day of the fire, August 8th, 2013, two men who worked for a restoration company stood outside of my house and watched the fire department put out the fire. When the fire department let me into the house, they immediately came to my rescue, the restoration company, and explained to me that I would not be able to use any of my belongings unless I worked with a company like them to restore my items. They capitalized on my denial and the fact that I was a victim of this violent crime and told me that my insurance company would cover all of their services and not to worry about anything. I found out a few days later, once I got my my brain back, that their services were covered under my personal property insurance, even though they had originally told me that it was coming out of my personal liability, which is a lot more money. At that point, I put a halt to their services. They charged me a little over $3,000 for everything they did that day, which amounted to inventorying the house, which I had told them I had already done. I had just moved from San Francisco a week before and had all my stuff inventoried by the moving company, and I had told them that. And cleaning some clothes and some electronics. My point being, they victimized the vulnerable by telling them blanket statements without giving estimates for their services. So in my email, I provided my solutions, which would be that restoration companies provide an outline for or an estimation for their services before work is done, just like any other contracting services for homes. And also that restoration companies are not allowed to use police scanners to ambulance chase and hang out at the scene of the crime in order to prey on victims. They must be called in by the victim or person wanting them their service. So
that's what you're requesting. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Brzezinski.
I'm wondering if you could tell us what steps you took with other state agencies. Did you contact the I want to say an attorney general's office as to...
So you can imagine that my memory is a little wrecked, but I complained to ATF, who was working with me on the arson investigation, and the man that I complained to put me in touch with the attorney general's office, and I spoke to them, and they didn't think that there was anything that could be done since I had signed a contract with the company. It's on my list of things to do to file a official claim with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Who would like to go next?
I'll go.
Go ahead.
Kelly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Chair Shields, Senator Przonski, Senator Montes Anderson, thank you for having me this afternoon. My name is Kelly Bach. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I represent 3,000 union firefighters throughout Oregon, and I also work as a frontline captain on a fire engine in the Portland metro area. I was asked today to speak to you about a new issue that some of our fire victims are facing, the unwanted or untimely solicitation for repairs or temporary building security by fire restoration companies. During a fire, or immediately after, as we just heard, the fire victim is under stress and has recently had a dramatic life event. They most certainly have lost belongings. They may have lost pets, lifelong sentimental items such as photos and artwork, and possibly important business information or a product. This is a time of duress, and making difficult decisions should not be pressured, and most certainly the victim should have accurate information to make a decision. Fire commanders have a lot on their plate. They are attempting to extinguish the fire, search for victims, control utilities, save belongings, account for firefighter safety, and at the same time, provide for the victim's security and safety. All of this at times when firefighter staffing levels are low and, of course, being fully utilized. My local union leaders in Portland, Salem, and Eugene have all recently reported that they have witnessed the increased presence of unsolicited fire restoration companies at building fires. We try to give the victim a safe place to go, but with scanners and new technologies, it is easier and easier for a company to hear of a fire, and several will show up attempting to get this business. They also do this earlier in a fire, when we are the most busy, and then the victim is most vulnerable. The victim may be standing on the sidewalk away from the fire. We're putting out the fire. They are not in the hot zone. Anybody can solicit them. At times, we try to put them in a neighbor's house with varying degrees of success. So they're definitely vulnerable. I'm by no means questioning the quality of the work of the restoration companies. I've never had it done firsthand. And I will assume that they have good intentions. But what really bugs us is this process makes us uneasy. The way the restoration companies are coming to the fire victims in their most vulnerable time, when they don't have an advocate, when they may not be making a good decision, we don't think is necessarily the best way to protect our citizens that we work so hard to protect, and then to have them victimized later after they've already had a traumatic event. I thank you for the time to present on this consumer protection topic, and hope that a solution is brought with a plan that protects the consumer and that works for the companies looking for this business. Yeah, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kelly. Chief Coons, welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Ted Coons. I'm the president of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and the fire chief and CEO in Canby. I, along with Kelly, share the exact same concern. In fire service all the time, we speak about Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And that's who our customer is. That's the person we go take care of on a daily basis. And we've said it before. We've said it here. We take care of people at their worst times and their worst days. And to see somebody come in and to use, I guess, your term of being ambulance chasers towards fires, there's a lot of concern with that within the fire chiefs. A couple of things really, really quick. As far as the scene goes, Kelly mentioned that. The incident commanders, we have a lot of different things that we're worried about, strategic objectives, but it always comes back again to the person, the consumer, the person that we're there to take care of. And I think any agency spends a lot of time and a lot of effort coming up with strategies to deal with those people. In a lot of cases in the metro area, we'll call in TriMet Bus, especially if we have folks that are multifamily dwellings, to come in, give them a warm place out of the rain, out of the weather, and so forth. So we spent a lot of time working on that, and I'll speak for Canby Fire. When this all kind of started with the restoration companies coming around a few years ago, we started a process in which if you want to be called by the fire district, in other words, you want to work with our people and stuff, there's some standards you have to meet. And currently, there's only three restoration companies in the Portland area that bother to go through a screening process with our fire district. The good news is when we find that person, they go, well, what do I do now? We can offer them an opportunity to work with a company that we know, number one, is not going to charge them. The only time they will see a bill is after they've agreed to something with their insurance company. We've had several cases in which we call it a restoration company and to take care of something, and the consumer and the insurance company decide to go with another vendor. Well, they understand that. That's part of the risk of working with the fire district. They don't bill any of their activities anywhere. They can't, per their agreement with the fire district. So the people are pre-screened. It creates positive relationships between us and our citizens, but it also creates positive relationships between the board of companies and the fire departments in the fact that they know what the rules are. They know that when they get there, they can't enter the premises till they got the permission of the incident commander. And in some case, that might be days, because especially if it's a crime scene, you mentioned the ATF being involved in your circumstance, nobody's going on that site until such time as the incident commander says so. In a lot of cases, I mean, the fire incident commander is responsible for everything that happens within that property where that fire has occurred. And for us, it's not only a matter of making sure we do the right thing, but it's a matter of liability for us. And then lastly, I hate to say protecting a crime scene if necessary. So, you know, for us, it's really important to support the victims of fire and other tragedies that we come up with. And we spent a lot of time developing strategies to do that. It alarmed me when our lobbyist informed me of the circumstance that was happening. In regards to the scanner one, I have to say that that'd be kind of tough. And I got my phone for one reason. I have an app on my phone, which I can listen to calls in my district, and it's an app anybody can buy. I don't know if we can stop them from listening to an app on their phone that says what's there, but if we can come up with some strategies to keep them from coming up to that person, approaching that person at a time when they're experiencing a terrible day, you know, for fire chiefs, we would all be in favor of that. The only thing I would ask is if we move forward with this, that we take into account systems that might be in place, like in districts like Tualatin Valley, Canby, and a lot of others, that already have systems in place that we don't just call anybody. We call people that we know we can trust and we have agreements with, that for the initial response, if they're not selected, they're rolling the dice on whether they ever get paid for it or not. So with that, I'd like to answer any questions.
Sure. So you actually have written agreements with mm-hmm. some companies who had a chance to apply and say, we want to be on certified yeah. good person list.
And if we hear any reports of them misbehaving, we'll approach them, give them a chance to respond to that. If we find out that they were doing it, we remove them from our list.
Okay. Interesting. I didn't know that was happening. Senator Przanski.
So I like that approach as to having that, let's say, buffer, and it seems to me that I would assume that the agencies that are under these type of agreements do their best to let the victims know, here's a list, if you would like to refer to it, we've made some screening and stuff like that, we'll be glad to try to help you. I've looked at the draft from my perspective would need to be majorly rewritten as to what's in there now. I have a lot of the concerns as to, as much as you might not want someone to be able to listen or solicit based on what they're hearing over the airwaves, we aren't going to be able to get there. But I think what's real important here is have the right to rescind. And we actually put into the bill that would allow for a victim so many days to rescind from a contract, because if you are hit up in an emotional time, and the way the bill's written out says when you likely or should know, and how are you going to really know that someone's still being impacted? Someone could be impacted for 12 hours or 12 days. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we really want to do is, if you find yourself, you know, into a contract, it's almost like with the used cars and that type of stuff, uh-huh. where you can actually go back and say, wait a second, you know, I've got my mind back and this is not what I want. And so that would be a consumer type protection. I also would encourage the chair and committee administrator to maybe check in with Representative Hovey and some of his contacts, because when I had the opportunity to do some of the commerce work, I know there are different mechanisms in place that we could actually maybe even address if these individuals are being licensed through DCBS. There may be some other certified smart people there that can give us some advantages mm-hmm. to make certain that there's going to be a way to, let's say, undo something that could be done at a very emotional time.
Mm-hmm. That's very good feedback. I think what might be helpful at this point is to have Chana kind of walk us through exactly what the bill does so we can get that on the record, and so that everybody out there will have that description. Can you walk
Certainly.
Us through the elements of the bill?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, with the caveat that I received this late this morning. So Section 1 puts this language within Chapter 701, which is the Construction Contractors and Contracts chapter of the ORSs. Section 2 gives power to the Construction Contractor Board to define the man-made and natural disasters within fire, flood, earthquake, crime, or other sudden major events. It defines restoration work. And then it says that a contractor may not directly and in person solicit restoration work business within 1,000 feet of property damaged by a man-made or natural disaster.
Can we stop there?
Okay.
Just on that. This is one of the issues I see, is that at some point they're going to have to go on the property, and they're going to be within that 1,000 feet, but this doesn't say within X number of hours or something like that, so that's the part we need to flush out, because at some point for them to be legitimately putting an offer together, they're going to have to be within that 1,000 feet, and right now the draft doesn't have any time frame, which is what I think we're trying to get at.
It's good. That's why it's nice to have lawyers on our committee.
Right. This section goes on to say that the contractor may not solicit restoration work from a property owner or occupant if the person making the solicitation knows or reasonably should have known that the physical, emotional, or mental state of the occupant or owner is such so that it would make that person unable to exercise reasonable judgment in contracting. Section 3 allows the construction contracting board to impose a fine of up to $10,000 for a first violation and $1,000 civil penalty thereafter, and potentially to suspend or revoke the license of the contractor. Section 4 deals with funds from that such fines, and that is the totality of the bill.
Okay. My staff person, Amanda Huss, who's done the majority of the work on this bill, like most bills that I ever have in front of me, has indicated that the Department of Justice has received 18 complaints on this topic, and that, contractor, the CCB, has indicated that this will have minimal fiscal impact. Senator Przanski.
So I'm assuming, based on the drafting of this, that CCB is claiming jurisdiction over this area, understanding that the work's done by, you know, it's basically restoration work, is construction type of work. So, but I'd also want to just see what, if anything, DCBS has, and then I think we need to figure out what is the bonding requirements for these companies. I will tell you, I have not been happy with some of the outcomes where there are disputes with CCB, where consumers have not been able to be paid because of the, the manner of how things are worked out, the extent of how many people are victims, and the bonding not being enough.
Good point. Senator Mona Sanderson. Yes,
thank you, Chair. I would like to know if this bill would be a better bill if there could be something in there about rescinding a contract.
That's
under
what you
the,
said.
Is that the same?
That's what I said at the beginning.
Is it?
Rescinding, in other words, giving
putting
her...
that in the...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it has to be in there. Or...
Good. Mm-hmm. And then the other is the licensing of these through the fire department. I thought it was interesting. Is that something that we could ask?
Yeah,
I don't know.
My staff person, Amanda, is in the back. Why don't you come on up and pull up a chair, if you wouldn't mind letting Teresa sit on your... I mean, Amanda, sit on your side there. Okay.
Not you. You can say
Amanda. Thanks, Kelly. Please identify yourself. Welcome to the committee, Amanda
Hi.
Huss.
My name is Amanda Huss. I'm the aide for State Senator Chip Shields. And I just wanted to walk through a couple things about in researching this issue and to fully put on the table that, it, you know, we need more smart minds around what the solution is and what it should look like, and just to tell you why it looks like it does now. So restoration company work, this example is fire, but restoration companies also... are victims of flood disasters, victims of the crime scenes. So pretty traumatic events. The bill, we don't want to go after restoration companies as a whole. They obviously, there are really good companies out there that are doing great work. It's this ambulance chasing tactic, and especially in victims of pretty traumatic events. The language that's currently in the bill, the 1,000 feet barrier comes from tow truck regulations. So a tow truck company can't solicit within 1,000 feet of a car accident. And the solicitation is, you know, if someone gives that, if someone's on the scene, like a firefighter, knows good companies and is in their policy and they want to tell you, like, hey, these are good companies to work with, that those folks could contact the company. That's not solicitation. They can contact the company and be on site. They just can't solicit on site, so they can't be a salesperson at the scene of the fire. I think it's a very good point about the duration of time, if that needs to be, you know, forever or a couple of days, and what type of work they're doing.
Can I just say something about the solicitation?
Yeah.
It was, I mean, it's like nothing you've ever seen. You know, my house is ruined. I lost all my stuff. And then across the street, there's men and women lined up next to houses that are fine with their suits on, like ready to do their whatever they do. And they look like the Red Cross. They look like the tip line in Northeast Portland. You know, they're like, you're just surrounded by people that want to help you after you lose your house. And they approach you in that same way. So the solicitation is not just one person being called. It's just a tremendous amount of pressure for the victim to navigate at that point. You know, for me, it was maybe 5 hours after the fire, which happened at 4 a.m. You know, so I just think I really wanted to emphasize that solicitation piece being just really burdensome to the victim.
And so with Teresa's case, we went to the Construction Contractors Board to begin with, because are they considered a construction agency or construction company? And you know, CCB, the director there, Craig Smith, is incredibly helpful, but also came back with, you know, in Teresa's instance, they just did cleaning. And CCB, like, the statute is pretty broad about repair, but they're not, but they weren't really sure that they could really do much, because they're not, they're more, their bailiwick is construction, and whether they wanted to take on more than that. So sort of where we're at with this bill is that, so to walk through it again, the second portion of it, the should reasonably know, that just comes straight out of attorney bar ethics rule. That's right out of, I think it's 7.2. Like, you can't solicit a client, like, you can't solicit a client as an attorney if you know or reasonably should know that they are not in the right mind to receive the service. So that's where those things come from. There's still a question about whether under CCB, CCB already has requirements about their contracts. Like, from my understanding, they already have requirements that have to say they have to put a bid on the contract, or at least put that they're under the CCB and that here's the contact information, so it's on the contract. If you look at Teresa's contract, there's nothing, there's like absolutely nothing that would help her in sort of navigating or even knowing to contact the DOJ. The CCB director has seen the draft and just emailed us today and was like, thanks for sharing. Let us know what the solution looks like. Right now, it looks minimal fiscal impact, but obviously.
Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, I got to tell you that, you know, the reality, it's what I'm hearing between the lines here. I'm wondering where CCB actually stands on regulating this or this type of business, because what I heard them you say they said is, well, you know, if they do construction, okay, but if they're doing cleaning, they don't. We need to figure out where they're at, if there are some type of regulations. Did the contract you have actually make those representations? Because the CCB process, where it comes to construction, they're supposed to give you this bid, and they're supposed to have certain documented information on there,
et cetera. It was basically a blank check.
I think one of the questions I would be asking is, let's figure out what, if any, regulatory agency has over this type of work. And I'm here to say I know there's some companies in the Eugene and Springfield area that are dynamite, excellent companies, very professional, that do their right and do it the way it should be done. But then again, just like in any industry, you have people that prey on people in their weakest moments. Yeah. And so to me, for this to actually have the impact that you would like, what we would want to see in the future, so people don't go through what you had to go through, is making certain that you have the information you need and you have a means of getting out of it.
And the part about that number three, the concern for me is that you could almost set up for litigation for even the good companies to say that, you know, they seem to be okay, and then for whatever reason the individual receiving the services has a disagreement on something, and then they claim this. I mean, it's kind of a two-way street. And so I just hope that we kind of make certain that we address this to the point that it's going to be sufficient and we won't have those unintended consequences.
I think one of the challenges in drafting, and correct me if I'm wrong, Amanda, is we're trying to figure out if this is fish or fowl, what kind of business. It's not really insurance, it's not really construction, and CCBs seem to be the place that, you know, the folks who are looking at it in LC decided would be the most logical place. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think we should go back and also recheck with DCBS, because this may be more of a general type of business that would fall under their bailiwick if it doesn't have the construction part. And this is not to find fault with CCB. They just may not have the expertise to deal with the whole magnitude of this type of charades these companies can be. I mean, $3,000 for what? For cleaning? For they're there for a day? And then they did something they weren't supposed to do, and they're trying to charge for that. That's the type of thing.
They charged me like over $1,000 for clothes that were worth, you know, maybe $400, maybe.
Right. And yeah, and then the inventory, clearly, I've worked with Craig Smith. He's a great individual. He tries to run, you know, agency on the top end. But that clearly is not going to be under their bailiwick as to regulating someone in the business of inventorying personal property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other comments about that, Amanda? Or?
Chairman Shields, if I could. Just real quick, you know, one thing that I read, got a chance to read through the legislative concept just before I came up, and one of the things that I guess would ask is if there can be some kind of language maybe within the statute, so we don't have to come back and visit this again, that allows the local government, the local body, to have the ability maybe to put additional requirements in, or have some kind of authority to regulate those are activities within their jurisdiction. In our case, you know, if we had the ability to, if, you know, we can demonstrate that we have put an ordinance in place that says this is how restoration companies have to function within the fire district, that's something we'd like to have more conversation about if we could.
Okay.
I think that's
it. Yeah, and if the police chiefs could go back, and maybe the League of Cities could go back, or counties, and if there's some suggested language out there, we'd love to see it.
Thank you.
And if I can make a request, could we get a copy of what you're actually providing to the victims? I'm very, let's say, concerned that it's one that has the disclaimers in there, so the individual victim understands that this is something, a service we're providing. We're not telling you should go with any of these. You know, y'all may already have all that in there, but I just think that because you could also be setting the districts up of some type of reliance that we went with what they told us to go with, and so you want to make certain, again, it's balanced. And I think the city code, if it's in a city that requires licensing, those cities would have the ability to have that additional ordinance protections and qualifications, what they have to do within their jurisdiction.
The interesting one is with fire districts, and the fact that our ordinance ability is pretty tight, and the fact that we don't have the authority to license and so forth like that. So that would be something we have to talk about. Use Clackamas County, for example. There's only two city fire departments in all of Clackamas County. All the rest of the cities are all protected by rural fire districts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's be something we can look at further.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think we also need to get an assurance, if we're going to be encouraging municipalities to do that, that it's a very transparent process, that it's a public process, that everybody has an equal shot to be on that list, and that it's very open. Good. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Hanger. And I think, you know, the fact that you had the courage, even through all the things that you've been dealing with, to come here and bring this idea to us is much appreciated. Usually the best ideas from regarding legislation come from people just like you, who said, hey, this shouldn't be going on, and then they contact their legislature. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Senator Shields. I appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am. All right. Would anyone like to come up and testify in support or express any concerns so that we would know what concerns might be out there? Okay. Then I'm going to ask Lori to move us into the next portion. I'm going to close the informational meeting, and I'm going to open a work session for the purposes of introducing LCs. Senator Mona Sanderson.
B3.
Yes.
Chair Shields, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC202, dated January 13, 2014. LC205, dated January 14, 2014. And this one.
Uh-huh.
And LC209, dated January 15, 2014.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC202, dated January 13, 2014. LC205, dated January 14, 2014. LC209, dated January 15, 2014. And just as a disclaimer, bills are being introduced as a courtesy to the committee and does not require a yes or no vote in the future. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, these LCs are adopted. Chan has brought to my attention, just a second, that I wanted to make sure everybody knew that we are meeting on Monday mornings at 8 a.m., the ungodly hour of 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. On Wednesdays, we are meeting from 3 to 5 during the February session, and we will be having an informational meeting at 10:30 a.m. after floor session, the first day of session on February 3rd.
You said that last one at 10:30 was what?
10:30, the first day. We'll be having an informational meeting after we leave the floor.
So we're not meeting at 8 in the morning.
That's
on
right.
Monday. We're meeting after the organization.
Yes, at 10:30.
Okay.
Senator Przanski.
So the LC 265, I'm assuming, is with the chairs, and you're going to be bringing that one forward?
That's right.
Okay.
Cool.
Great.
All right. Is there anything else, Chan?
No.
I wish you know. This meeting is adjourned.
And before you go. And before you go.